specialized circulations, and specifically we're talking about the heart and how the coronary blood flow is regulated to deliver oxygen. So we talked about the coronary circulation, we talked about the anatomy, and we talked about the regulation of myocardial oxygen consumption. And the last points we left was that the extraction at rest was extremely high, about 16, and therefore increases in myocardial oxygen consumption have to be due to increases in flow. So that's a prerequisite. We can't extract more, we have to deliver more. And this is shown in figure 30-5 from Byrne and Levy. And it shows myocardial oxygen consumption as a linear function of coronary blood flow. Okay, now coronary blood flow, like all other flows, again follows the Ohm's law. We've got delta P over resistance. So in this particular case, coronary blood flow equals the driving force, and the driving force is mean arterial pressure minus the pressure in the coronary sinus. That's the other end of the coronary vasculature. And this is close to zero, so this is really not a concern here. All over the resistance to coronary blood flow. Now, normally, coronary blood flow, the driving force is constant. Mean arterial pressure is kept at a constant level. So unless, you know, you're hypertensive or something like that, this is not really part of the equation. This is constant, and so the variable here is resistance. And resistance, once again, like all other blood vessels, is related to radius to the fourth power. So that's really what we're talking about, as we are in most vasculatures, varying the radius of the blood vessels to increase coronary blood flow, in turn to increase myocardial oxygen consumption. So for the next few minutes, we're going to talk about what is it that controls the resistance to flow. Okay? So the first factor is a mechanical factor, and I'll talk about that. And the blood vessels, the coronary blood vessels, actually have to transverse through the heart. And the heart, of course, is beating at somewhere between 60 and 180 beats per minute. And during contraction, so this is the ventricular wall, and the coronary blood vessel is coming through here. This blood vessel right here is prone to what's happening in the ventricular wall, which is contracting. And so it gets compressed, and as it gets compressed, the radius gets smaller and the resistance increases. So the coronary blood flow is affected by mechanical factors in the heart, much more so than just about any other tissue, with the exception of skeletal muscle. And then several other factors I'm going to talk about after this is autoregulation, which we've talked about before, neural factors, which we've talked about before, and metabolic factors. So we've talked about all of these as concepts. We haven't talked about mechanical before, but we're going to talk about the specifics with respect to the coronary blood flow of these other factors. Okay, in terms of mechanical, this is shown in figure 30-3. And what's shown here on the top panel is the aortic blood pressure trace. So this is systole right here, dicrotic notch, and then relaxation, and then we have diastole that's occurring right here. So you're familiar with that. In the bottom panel, there's two figures that both represent coronary blood flow. The top panel represents coronary blood flow to the left coronary artery, and the bottom one to the right coronary artery. And so systole, which is shown here in the dashed lines, and diastole have very different responses, have very different coronary blood flows. If we look in the left coronary artery, we can see that the blood flow during systole is about 40, whereas it reaches a peak of about 100 during diastole. In other words, the flow is about 2.5 times greater in diastole than it is in systole. And this is a direct consequence of the fact that during systole we have mechanical compression, and the resistance is increased, even though the driving force is actually slightly higher during systole because the systolic pressure is higher, or we're achieving systolic pressures, even though the driving force is slightly higher, the flow is less because of the compression and therefore the increased resistance. So for the left side of the heart, the majority of the blood flows during diastole. And this is a very important concept. So the diastolic interval is a good indication of the flow because that's the time in which flow is occurring. If we look at the right side of the heart, however, the opposite is true. During systole, we have more flow than we have during diastole, slightly more. Anyone know what? No takers? No? All right, we've been through this concept before. The right side of the heart here, this is serving the right side of the heart, and so that the right coronary vessels are traversing the wall, but on the right side of the heart, and so we're dealing with the right ventricle. And the right ventricle is subserving the pulmonary circulation, which is a much lower pressure, much lower resistance circulatory system. And therefore, the compression factors on the right ventricle are much less than they are on the left ventricle, partly because of the forces generated and partly because the thickness of the wall of the left ventricle exceeds that of the right ventricle. So the mechanical factors are different on the left and right side of the heart. And that's manifested in differences in the blood flow. So on the left side, blood flow is occurring mostly during diastole. On the right side, it's mostly during systole. Okay? Any questions on that? All right, the next factor is autoregulation. This is figure 30-2, and we've been through this concept before. Autoregulation is a means of giving some constancy to blood flow over a range of perfusion pressures by adaptations that occur within the blood vessel. And remember, we talked about myogenic tone being responsible for this increased resistance at high pressures. If the pressures are too high and flow increases disproportionate to the actual needs of the heart, one, we're wasting flow that could go somewhere else, and two is we have the consequences of possible edema because at the level of the capillaries we have a problem. So we have this auto regulation, which is important in several vascular beds, the heart included. Okay, we've talked about that before. Let's talk about neural factors now. Now, as I mentioned before, neural factors can be originate from the sympathetic nervous system or the parasympathetic nervous system. And with respect to the sympathetic nervous system, we have two effects. We have an alpha-mediated response, alpha adrenergic receptor-mediated response on the vascular smooth muscle cells. So now we're talking about the coronary arteries. Specifically, we're talking about the coronary arterioles that have vascular smooth muscle cells wrapped around them, and they have alpha adrenergic receptors on them. And when noradrenaline is released, it results in a cascade that you're familiar with. It produces IP3 and causes vasoconstriction. And this is a very important effect on the heart. Now, the heart has, more so than many vascular beds, a very high intrinsic vasomotor tone. This is very important. So as we sit here in a rested state, the sympathetic nervous system and other factors are vasoconstricting your blood vessels so that they are largely occluded. So at rest, this high tone is a consequence of a high degree of vasoconstriction. This is extremely important because, as I mentioned before, the heart and some other organs have local regulation. Local regulation is a way of fine-tuning the flow so that the flow meets the demand for blood. And so we have a good balance between supply and demand by metabolic adjustments, which I'll talk about in a moment. But as you may recall, the metabolic factors are all vasodilatory factors. So, if the blood vessel is already vasodilated, the metabolic factors have no effect. They can only work on blood vessels that are constricted to a certain degree. So having a high intrinsic tone mediated by the sympathetic nervous system is a natural and critical part of the coronary circulation. Now we have as well effects of beta, beta 1 adrenergic receptors, and they can result in vasodilation. And we have acetylcholine, which can result in vasodilation, etc. But I'm focusing on the alpha adrenergic receptors here because of their importance. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. Metabolic. We talked about the variety of possible signals that are produced when tissue is not receiving enough blood. When there's an imbalance between supply and demand, it means the heart and other tissues are working anaerobically, and when they do so, they produce these metabolites, which are vasodilators. And we went through a list of a whole bunch of potential vasodilators, including decreased PO2, increased CO2, potassium, drop in pH, adenosine, etc., etc. The importance of this, of the metabolic factors, is shown in this two concepts of reactive and active hyperemia. And let me just talk about those because they apply to other tissues like skeletal muscle. So in order to show this, I'm going to look at two parameters. One is flow. So we'll say the flow here is at a high level. We'll just put it at 100, an arbitrary value of 100. And then at some point right here, we stop flow, and we could stop it to a value of 100 or so, to zero, again, an arbitrary figure, and we can hold the coronary blood flow at zero for a period of time. Now, this is not something that you do at home, but this is something you can do experimentally. And so what we can do is, in this type of experiment, is we're occluding blood flow to various degrees. We could have it occluded by 50%. In this case, I've occluded 100%. And we can occlude it for different intervals, different durations. And so right here, we have occlusion. And at this point right here, we remove the occlusion. So we reopen. And as we do so, the blood flow returns. But the blood flow does not return to its basal level, which was 100 prior to this occlusion. It exceeds it, and it exceeds it for a period of time. And so this phenomenon of overcompensation that I'm showing in the crossed lines here is a blood flow that exceeds what you'd expect for the normal metabolic requirements. The word for this is hyperemia. This means hyperemia means increased blood flow. It's called reactive hyperemia because the hyperemia is in response to this occlusion. Now, if we were to show metabolites, we could show adenosine, for example. So adenosine concentration would be very low under these conditions and would be increasing during the period of occlusion and then eventually would be decreasing like this. Now, the exact factor that mediates reactive hyperemia is controversial. And as I mentioned before, Byrne, one of the authors of the textbook, he worked on adenosine for about 35 years. And he was one of the main proponents of adenosine being the factor that mediates reactive hyperemia or in general metabolic factors. But you may recall, I listed many other factors. And the truth is, we don't really know what it is that's causing this, but certainly adenosine increases in concentration, and adenosine is a very potent vasodilator. So there's some reason to support the adenosine hypothesis, but there's other factors as well. So I don't want to oversimplify it by saying it's adenosine, but adenosine could be involved. So reactive hyperemia is in response to an occlusion here, and if we increase the duration of the occlusion, or we increase the magnitude of the occlusion, Now, in this example, I've maximally occluded it. But the reactive hyperemia is proportional to the duration and the magnitude of the ischemia. So I'll just say RH, reactive hyperemia, is proportional to both the duration and the magnitude of the ischemic event that precedes it. And this is suggestive of the fact that during this period of ischemia, metabolites are accumulating, and the longer the ischemia, the more severe the ischemia, the greater the accumulation of metabolites, and therefore the greater effect of on hyperemia subsequent to this. And then as blood flow increases, it washes out the metabolites, and so then the thing comes back to normal. Now, active hyperemia is something that's very similar, and it simply means, or it's referring to a situation where you increase the work done by the heart, you start walking up a flight of stairs, and the heart is demanding more oxygen because it's using more oxygen, using more ATP, and we create not an occlusion, but we have an imbalance between supply and demand. And so in essence, we have ischemia despite the fact that we have normal blood flow. So even though blood flow has stayed constant, the demand for blood has increased, therefore we have an imbalance between supply and demand. We create metabolites, and the metabolites cause an active hyperemia. So these are very important factors. And the heart is regulated on a beat-to-beat basis by metabolic factors overriding neural factors and other ones, so that the supply and demand is neatly balanced in the healthy heart. Of course, later on we'll talk about the unhealthy heart, the presence of atherosclerosis or compromised coronary blood flow, and what happens here. But just to give you an example of how the heart works, if I were to take the fittest among you right now and take you down to the track and have you run a 100-meter dash, or let's say 200 meters, that almost all of you, even you guys, what are you guys, 15 or 16 years old? I mean, you guys are pretty young and pretty healthy. Almost all of you would show signs of ischemia if we put electrodes on your heart and looked at indices like ST wave changes. All of you would show signs of an ischemic event going on. Okay? Why is that? Doesn't mean you're abnormal. You may be abnormal, I don't know, but your heart is still healthy and will show this response. Exactly. So if I wanted you not to have this event occur, then what would I ask you to do? Yeah, warm up, run a couple laps, and your blood flow is stimulated to the heart, and the lag time between these two events isn't as serious, and the degree of ischemia isn't as serious. So if you start cold, the heart has a lag time between the vasoconstriction induced by the sympathetic nervous system and the vasodilation that occurs because of metabolites being generated, and that is taking seconds. Okay? I think these are summarized by factors here. This is figure 30-6. It's not such an important slide, but it's talking about coronary blood flow and arterial O2 content. This is not really changing that much unless you have problems with anemia or altitude, etc. So this is usually pretty constant. But coronary blood flow is the factor supplying O2 to the heart and balancing supply and demand. The next one is a summary of the factors that work on the heart. And this is sort of Robert Burns' baby. It talks about the factors I just mentioned. We have mechanical compression during systole. We have a myogenic mechanism that's involved in autoregulation. We have neural factors, particularly the alpha-adrenergic receptors, are positive in the sense that they vasoconstrict. Beta receptors can tend to vasodilate, usually with a much slower time frame than the alpha. So the first response of the sympathetic nervous system is to vasoconstrict. Vagus nerves are relatively unimportant on the scale of things here, but they do tend to vasodilate. Then we have metabolic factors. We have all of these, adenosine, all these things, which are all vasodilatory. Well, there's a few here, but almost all of them are vasodilatory, and they tend to override the vasoconstriction induced by the sympathetic nervous system. So So the heart, this is figure 37 from the Burn and Levy text. The blood vessels in the heart are constantly undergoing a balance between supply and demand. Okay? Now let's just take an example of someone with atherosclerosis. And I mentioned this to you before. If we took a person with very severe atherosclerosis and we put them on this table and did an EKG, the EKG is very likely to be normal. And remember, the EKG is going to reflect ischemic events or an imbalance between supply and demand. And so a resting EKG is not really useful or informative to diagnose atherosclerosis, even when it's fairly severe. But if you put that person on a treadmill, you can unmask the underlying coronary vascular disease, and you start seeing signs of ischemia. So, in that circumstance, what's happening is the person that has compromised blood flow, they are naturally undergoing vasodilation at rest. In other words, they have achieved an overriding of the sympathetic nervous system and dilating the blood vessels simply to meet the demand of the resting heart. And so what this is referred to as, in the resting state, they have decreased their vasodilatory reserve. Remember, the whole point of having vasoconstriction is that you can override it with metabolites. These people may be overriding it with metabolites just to meet resting conditions, and now when you put them on a treadmill and you ask the heart to do even more work, they reach the point in which they can no longer vasodilate any further because they're already compromised. And now we have a huge imbalance in supply and demand, and we get EKG manifestations of that, which we'll talk about later on. Okay? Any questions on that? No? Okay. Next one, skeletal muscle, I'm going to talk about very quickly. Skeletal muscle is like cardiac muscle in many respects. It has some autoregulation. It's controlled by metabolites. It's not nearly as vascularized, and it's much more tolerant of being deprived of blood flow and oxygen. Much more tolerant. So it doesn't have the sophisticated regulation between supply and demand because it can tolerate the absence of adequate blood flow for a period of time. But it has some other things which I don't really have time to talk about. Okay, next thing is the brain. Blood flow to the brain. So the brain is an interesting organ. It receives 15% of your cardiac output, but it represents only 2% of your body weight. For some people, 2% obviously is, for some people it's, you know, it's 0.5%, and some people it's 7%, but it's a small fraction, yet it's receiving a disproportionate amount of blood. And this is a reflection of the fact that your brain is highly active metabolically. And it's highly active metabolically to serve the kinds of needs, you know, you're taking notes and those kinds of things. There's energy going on. But the interesting thing about the brain is that its percentage of the cardiac output varies, but the flow remains relatively constant over a variety of circumstances. Okay? So the flow to the brain remains relatively constant. Even when cardiac output increases dramatically when you're exercising, flow to the brain remains constant. And this is important because the brain's not very tolerant of ischemia. It's even worse than the heart. When the heart is deprived of oxygen, you see changes in EKG and you may get a myocardial infarction. When the brain is deprived of oxygen, you get stroke-like symptoms that are often irreversible. There are certain situations that you may be familiar with in which the brain can be more tolerant, but in general, it does not function well in the absence of oxygen, and even 2 or 3 minutes of oxygen deprivation can result in irreversible damage. So the blood flow to the brain is very important. The fact that the flow is constant over a wide range of blood pressures, over a wide range of conditions, including sedentary to maximal exercise, is a reflection that the blood flow, and when I say blood flow, I mean the overall blood flow to the brain, is controlled by autoregulation. And this keeps the constancy of flow over a wide range of conditions. However, even though the overall flow to the brain is remaining relatively constant, we have regional changes in blood flow which are going on from minute to minute depending on what your brain is doing. And these are controlled by metabolic factors, much as we see in the heart. We have metabolites that are produced. When parts of the brain are being active, they're generating metabolites. They vasodilate, they decrease the resistance, and we have local changes in blood flow. And I think they're shown coming up here. Oh yeah, the other thing is the blood-brain barrier, which I indicated before. This is largely a function of the nature of the capillaries in the blood-brain, on the blood vessels in the brain, and it's extremely important. It protects the brain from some noxious elements that are being perfused through the body. So this is the circulatory system that perfuses the brain. And we have blood coming from the left and right external and internal carotids right here, and they go into the circle of Willis right here, which is at the base of the brain. And this is coming off of the aorta, the subclavian right here. And we can see it from another perspective here. So the left and right internal carotid arteries are supplying most of the blood to the brain. So we have a relative constancy of flow going up the left and right internal carotid arteries, but you'll see in the next slide, and these two figures are taken from the boron text, and someone emailed me and said they actually like the boron text, so I'm glad they like it. This shows the brain doing different things, and the areas that are lit up are by using different imaging techniques to look at changes in blood flow. In this case, they use xenon, but you can also use deoxyglucose, you can use other things which reflect the activity of the brain, and you can image it. You can image it with PET scans, you can do it with MRI, you can do it in a variety of ways depending what the probe is. Here it's a radioactive probe. I think it's a radioactive probe. But you can see that different parts are used for different kinds of intellectual activities, and the flow is changed so that it goes to those areas, which makes sense, even though the total flow to the brain hasn't changed dramatically. Okay, any questions on that? No? Okay. The next one is renal blood flow. Now, the renal blood flow is different in several respects from the other types of special circulations we've talked about. For all of the other ones, the heart, the skeletal muscle, and the brain, the blood flow is used primarily to fuel the cells because of their high metabolic needs. In the kidney, however, most of the blood is going for filtration, which you learned about in 205, and we're going to talk about more in the blood pressure regulation section. So the kidneys themselves require oxygen because the kidneys have a high metabolic rate, but they receive a flow that's disproportionate to the amount of metabolic activity in the kidneys. And so if this is the aorta, the blood flow to the kidneys is through the renal artery. Like this. And about 20% of your total cardiac output, one-fifth of your total cardiac output is going to your kidneys. Yet the kidneys represent a very small mass of the total body weight. Now, if we look inside, we have blood flow going to the individual nephrons, and in the nephrons we have a glomerulus that may look something like this, and we have an afferent and an efferent arteriole, and I'll go through this, and I have actually pictures, not just my crappy drawings, and this blood flow right here allows for filtration. The filtration goes across the capillaries in this glomerulus and allows for filtration of the blood, and it goes into the nephron, into the descending and ascending tubules, blah, 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 into the collecting duct. So most of the flow that's going to the kidneys is serving this purpose, which is extremely important because the kidneys are playing a role in regulating the constituents in the blood. They're regulating the sodium concentration, the potassium concentration, concentration of urea, a bunch of other factors. So they're It's important. And of course, as you know, if your kidneys malfunction, if your kidneys go into failure, you'll die from toxemia. And for people that have kidney failure, they go into a process of dialysis in which a machine, or the peritoneum, plays a similar role to detoxify, for lack of a better word, this, the blood that's going through the structure. So we've got 20% of the cardiac output. When we normalize by weight, this is 7 times greater than the brain. And yet the brain was receiving a hugely disproportionate amount of blood because it's a fairly highly active, in terms of metabolism, organ. So this is a result of a reflection of two things. The kidneys have a fairly high metabolic rate themselves because they're undergoing a lot of active transport at the level of these tubules to remove sodium and potassium, which I think you're familiar with. We'll talk about a little bit later on, but there's a lot of transporters, active transporters. But the majority of the blood is simply being used for filtration right here. And the flow to the kidneys is also kept relatively constant over a wide range of pressures and over a wide range of conditions. So when we start exercising, our cardiac output may increase by a factor of 4 or 5. And when we do so, the flow to the kidneys remains relatively constant. So what that means is the percent of the total cardiac output when you're exercising going to the kidneys decreases, but the flow in milliliters per minute is relatively the same. So the brain and the kidneys are both receiving relatively constant flows for obvious reasons. Okay. Now skin. Skin is like kidneys in the sense that a large proportion of the blood flow to the skin is not to subserve the metabolic needs of the tissue. Part of it is, but a good percentage of the blood flow is for an entirely different purpose, and oxygen is not being extracted, just like in the kidneys at the glomerulus. It's not really extracting oxygen, it's filtering the oxygen. In skin, this purpose is to play a role in temperature regulation, as you're probably already aware. And the temperature regulation, of course, really depends on your level of activity and the environment in which you're functioning. So the importance of the blood flow to the skin is a function of primarily those two factors. And they're summarized on the next slide, which is taken from the boron text. So this is someone running, and it shows all of the balances of heat transfer from the body to the environment and from the environment to the body. And as you know, we have convection and radiation, evaporation, you know, the usual things. And this is something that's discussed, if you're interested, it's discussed in environmental physiology classes in a lot more detail. But one important facet is to keep core temperature relatively constant, or at least keep it below a lethal value, is using skin blood flow to enhance loss of heat at that level. And conversely, in colder environments, to reduce the loss of heat through reducing skin blood flow. Okay? And this is a very simplistic view of the temperature regulation. And it's simplistic because, you know, some of you are already aware that there's more than one type of sensor in the in the skin. There's cold and warm receptors. I won't go into that. But core temperature is crucial here. And core temperature is kept at a value of around 37 degrees. If it gets to values close to 40, these can be lethal. And it's lethal because organs like the brain and the heart undergo serious problems. Proteins start to unfold and we get serious problems. On the other end, too, as blood temperature drops, or core temperature drops below 33 degrees, we have a hypothermia. So in both senses, hyper and hypothermia can be lethal, as you well know. And so in the hypothalamus, we have very important set points for constancy, or relatively constancy, of body temperature. And that's mediated by different efferent pathways. And I won't go into these, I'm just going to focus on the skin and changing the vasomotor activity of the skin. And this is controlled, the controller in this efferent pathway is largely the sympathetic nervous system, and largely through alpha-mediated vasoconstriction, so that we can increase or decrease the resistance in the vascular beds to the skin, increasing or decreasing flow. And that's shown in the next slide, which is also from the boron text. And it shows flow to the skin in two areas, apical skin and non-apical skin. Apical skin is the skin that really plays a crucial role in temperature regulation. It's the parts of the body, or the parts of the skin. The skin you can consider an organ. It's the largest organ we have. The skin in the apical skin region here is that part which is crucial for temperature regulation. And the non-apical skin is less important. So from a cardiovascular point of view, the factors that are important here is that we have capillary beds like we do for all tissues. And remember, capillaries, the role of the capillaries here is to allow for exchange between the surrounding tissue and the blood. And this is to meet the metabolic needs, to deliver nutrients, to remove metabolites. But in addition to that, because a large amount of the flow is not to meet the metabolic needs, but in this case, to either get rid of heat or conserve heat, we have these structures, these anastomoses, right here that link the arterioles and the venules. They're a bypass system that allows for high throughput of blood from the arterial side to the venous side. The capillaries is fairly restrictive, and you're trying to remember the blood flow velocity decreases in the capillaries to promote exchange. In this structure right here, this shortcut, we can have a very high flow rate going from the arterial to the venous side of the circulation, increasing loss of heat as we increase the flow. And this is controlled largely by the sympathetic nervous system, vasoconstricting these structures, and the sympathetic nervous system is being controlled centrally from the hypothalamus. So blood flow to the skin can be changed by vasoconstricting the smooth muscles, or in the case of cold, or in the case of hot, reducing the output to the sympathetic nervous system and resulting in vasodilation. Okay? So much for skin. Any questions so far? No? Okay. Let's talk about the fetal circulation now. The fetal circulation obviously is quite different. It's different from anything we've seen before. And the main reason is it's different is that while the fetus has lungs, the lungs in the fetus just don't get to see that much oxygen. In other words, the fetus is not breathing inside the uterus. It's not breathing in a way that's functional. And so the important event in the fetus has a developing brain. The brain is relatively intolerant to ischemia, so we need to have blood flow to the brain. We need to have oxygen delivery to the brain. And the same is true for the fetal heart. We need to have blood flow going to the fetus while it's undergoing gestation, or else the development will not be normal. And so if it's deprived of oxygen, then it will cause developmental changes either in the size of the fetus or more seriously, the development of the brain, which could be irreversible, or the development of the heart. So as you know, the fetus is not getting oxygen for itself, it's getting oxygen from the mother, and there's a variety of structures in place that allow for this to occur. Okay, so we have specialized structures, and we're going to talk about four or five specialized structures within the fetus and the fetal circulatory system that accomplish this goal of getting blood from the mother to the fetus to meet the conditions I just talked about. That is, the brain and the heart, among other organs, need to get adequate blood flow, or else we have very serious consequences. The first one is the placenta. And I'll come back and talk about that. Within the placenta, there are specific structures known as trophoblasts. The next one is the ductus venosus. And this connects the umbilical vein, which I'll show you in a minute, to the inferior vena cava. This is a specialized structure that we don't have, but we used to have a while ago when we were in the womb. The third structure is the foramen ovale. This connects the right atrium to the left atrium. Very important structure. As you probably know, sometimes this hole that links the two doesn't close, and this causes some problems when the baby's born. I'll talk about that later on. The next structure is the ductus arteriosus, and it connects the pulmonary artery to the aorta. And the last structure, which I probably won't focus on too much, is the crista dividens, shown here. And it directs the blood flow from the superior vena cava and inferior vena cava to different pathways. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Okay? So those are the basic structures that we're going to look at, and now we're going to put them into a functional context. Now this slide is from the alternative text in figure 56.2, and as you can see, it's a pretty busy slide. So let's go through this slowly. The structure right here is the placenta. This is the interface between the fetus and the mother. The specialized structures within here include the umbilical cord, obviously, And we'll see later on within here we have these trophoblasts, which aren't shown here, but we'll see them in more detail later on. So the fetal blood gets oxygenated in the placenta from maternal blood. And it's sort of like the equivalent of a lung, but the transfer is quite different. It's blood on blood, basically, rather than blood in air. But in the umbilical cord right here, we have an umbilical vein, which is carrying the blood from the placenta to the fetal circulation. This umbilical vein is carrying the oxygenated blood. That's why it's shown in red. So some of you may have problems, you know, you think of veins carrying deoxygenated blood. Well, you already know in the heart that's not always true, and this is certainly another example. The umbilical vein here is carrying blood back to the right side of the heart eventually. So, in the placenta, the blood gets oxygenated. The blood goes into the umbilical vein through the umbilical cord. The other part of the umbilical cord is the umbilical artery, shown in blue right here. The umbilical vein then delivers the blood to the circulation of the fetus right here at the inferior vena cava in the abdomen, right near the liver. And this structure right here is known as the ductus venosus, allowing these two to be linked together. And of course, the umbilical vein and artery don't exist after birth, so we're going to talk about how it makes adjustments at delivery. But while it's the fetus, while we have undergoing gestation, we have this very important structure. Now, the heart is right here, and they've shown the heart with the atria at the bottom and the ventricles at the top. Just for sake of simplicity, the heart isn't inverted in the fetus. But this oxygenated blood, and before I continue, I just want to point out that the blood that's oxygenated here really is the PO2 isn't as high as it is in the adult. But the fetus has a specialized type of hemoglobin which has very high affinity for oxygen. And so it's able to pick up large amounts of oxygen for the same degree of partial pressure of oxygen. And then the fetal form of hemoglobin switches to an adult form after birth. So this oxygenated blood comes up, it goes into the inferior vena cava, it's mixing with desaturated blood, and it's going into the right atrium right here. Now in the right atrium, it goes into the foramen ovale, which I talked about before, which is linking the right atrium with the right ventricle. It's a hole in the heart, in the atrium, and has a valve-like structure, which is shown right here. Now this inset, the heart is shown in its normal configuration, atrium top and the ventricles below. And here it's just inverted, just for simplicity. So this oxygenated blood is coming up the inferior vena cava into the right atrium and is deflected into the left atrium and into the left ventricle. And it's propelled from the left ventricle into the aorta and then largely to the brain. Okay? The importance of this is that the brain is getting blood that's the most highly oxygen-saturated blood that we can see. So that the brain is considered more important than the other organs from this perspective, and the heart as well. So that it's seeing highly oxygenated blood from a relative point of view. From a fetal point of view, this is as saturated as the blood gets. So it's going out of the, it's going into the right atrium, left atrium, left ventricle, aorta, and then up into the brain, which is shown over here on the side, to supply the brain. The coronaries are coming off right here. So the coronaries are feeding the fetal heart with relatively highly saturated blood. Okay? And the blood in the brain and the upper body and the heart, it goes through capillaries. We have exchange, just like we do in the adult. We have starling relationships, filtration, absorption. Oxygen goes in. And then we go to venules and veins, and the superior vena cava is collecting all these. And the superior vena cava is bringing the blood back into here, into the right atrium, but this blood is now going into the right ventricle, and it's going out of the pulmonary vein, and then into the pulmonary artery, And into the structure, this is the ductus arteriosus right here. And the ductus arteriosus is linking these two structures. And remember that in the adult, this vasculature is meant to direct most, well, almost all of the blood here into the lungs, into the pulmonary circulation for oxygenation. In the fetus, this is not so important because the blood is not getting oxygenated in the lungs. On the other hand, the lungs are living tissue in the fetus. They're not functional from the point of view of oxygenating blood, but they are living tissue that require oxygen. So a small amount of the blood actually goes to the lungs to subserve the functional needs of the lung tissue. But the vast majority is going into the descending aorta, supplying the rest of the body, the abdomen, the legs, etc. And then eventually all this blood comes into the umbilical vein, umbilical artery, gets oxygenated and goes through this pathway. Okay, I know that's a lot of information, but the structures here that I pointed out earlier that I'm going to come back to on Friday is the placenta, the ductus venosus, the foramen ovale, and the ductus arteriosus right here. And these all play a role to serve the unique circulatory demands that the fetus places on the mother. Okay? Any questions?